Hello, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which doesn't exist!
It doesn't exist! It
doesn't exist.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm still here.
And we are back looking at the beginning of Patrick Troughton's third year as the Doctor, season 6 of Doctor Who, and the last Doctor Who season in black and white. Also the last Doctor Who season with any missing episodes. So we're going to go into a story which I think has the record for missing episodes for Doctor Who, because it had a missing episode even before it finished filming, The Dominators.
It's kind of the one where you kind of wish there were slightly more missing episodes, actually.
We've had it for a long time, haven't we?
Do you know, when we were kids, Richard, before he was born, actually soon after he was born, but his skull probably hadn't hardened.
It's an interesting distinction.
In about 1986... they showed some Patrick Troughton, and it was the first time I remembered them doing it, because they used to cycle through. They used to show you all the Pertwees without the Master in, and then they would show you sort of Tom Baker up until the present day, and then it would be back to sort of Spearhead from Space, and then, you know, skipping season 8 and all of that. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
But they showed two Troughtons, I think, in 1986.
Crotons
and Mind Robber. So they're both from this season, and they're both ones that we'll be discussing in the next couple of podcasts.
Yes, and they're also both ones that my father taped on VHS. They were part of the VHS collection I had to watch as a child.
So you had early experiences of them as well. But mysteriously, like other ones that did exist at the time, like The Dominators, did that exist in full at the time?
I believe it did.
Yeah, and I think Seeds of Death has existed for a long time as well.
Yes, that had a very early VHS omnibus release.
Right. So The Dominators, mysteriously, why wouldn't they have shown it then? Just because it's so terrible?
No, they wouldn't have thought like that. It was probably just because it was a few episode count out.
Yeah, because they would have. The other two were four-parters.
Well, Mind Robber wasn't.
Oh, no, Mind Robber's five-parts as well. Yeah.
Mind Robber was written as four, though, produced as four, and it got an extra episode because they cut one out of this story to squeeze it. This is the one where it's not written by a fellow called Norman Ashby. It's actually Mervyn Hazeman and Henry Lincoln, who brought us the Yeti sitting on our loos in Tooton Beck. And this is the story where the writers not only begged the BBC not to show the story, they threatened to sue the BBC not to show the story.
Because they thought it was so changed from their initial
vision. Yeah, it's not exactly because it's a whole pile of Yeti droppings, but Look, this story is really interesting for what it's about and what it's reflecting. To understand this story, and we've got a peaceful planet where old blokes get around in dresses and a pretty
ineffectual,
really awful high-waisted skirty dresses, and the TARDIS going on holiday, so they drop Paddy off onto a beach again, and it's a nice little holiday, but then it turns out to have been an island that's a nuclear testing ground, and then a really groovy woo-woo spaceship, which is actually a jelly mould and is admitted by Jack Klein's department to be a jelly mould.
It was a jelly mould,
because they ran out, because they were BBC effects boys, so there were only a few of them, and they were having to do every single thing, and they were getting a bit cross, so bugger you, we'll use a jelly mould. Yeah. It was almost to the point of that. But the interior set of the ship is really gorgeous.
Well, it's very Newbury designed sets, and they're spectacular.
They're certainly, they're very Bondy, and they're very Kubricky, and they're very kind of lattice-like, and there's lots going on in there, which is really useful, because you can look at the sets instead of paying attention to the plot, which is the same script for, you know, each and every episode just rebooted. So that this jelly mould lands on a deserted island that turns out to be radioactive, and their first act of consciousness and kindness is actually to soak up all the radiation because their ship's driven by this stuff. So it's not really explicit in the story, is it? But that's what they do. And then they step out as Joan and Jackie Collins, because they've both got the same razor cut hairdos and shoulder pads that defy description. Unless you know the K1 giant robot from Tom Baker's first story, and you go, that's what that's.
So can we just go back to the beginning for a second? Because it's a season opener, and so they start with this spectacular special effects sequence, which is a fleet of flying saucers that look just truly terrible. And then the flying saucer lands with Joan and Jackie.
They've got jagged teeth.
Well, in fact, one of them is the guy who just a year later will play Professor Cornish in Ambassadors of Death.
Yes.
And he'll be spectacularly handsome in that. But
Ronald Allen. Yeah. He's also in Inferno as a reader on... There's one of the boys is the... Yeah,
the voice of the computer. Voice.
He's sitting around just reading stuff out.
Yeah.
And he was later on, was it Crossroads or one of the soaps?
Crossroads, he was very famous.
Yeah, he's kind of famous and a bit dashing and super smart. He's actually a really clever bloke.
But here he just looks like he's had a few really seriously late nights and he's been
hitting the turf. I think it's the Leonard Nimoy approach of the only way you can make it through the day is to be completely inebriated. Nimoy said that on Trek. His last season, he was drunk pretty much every shooting.
That was just working with Shatner.
Kind of the same thing. They've also got jagged teeth, so I think there's a nice thing that, have you noticed they're painted slightly jagged teeth, so I think they're actually all related to what's-his-face off Dalek Master Plan. Who's the one?
Trantis.
Thank you. And they've got two hearts.
They do have two hearts.
They've got two hearts because they're really surprised that Jamie's only got one heart. And I think the Dolchians, who are the hippies, all just like the Minions. They're probably all seeded from the early colonial days of Time Lordiness.
Yeah.
Because the Doctor actually has been here before and thinks they're all going to have a nice holiday on the beach. So, really, maybe this is all a bit of a payback, and there's more. I'm desperately looking for things that are more interesting than it's actually going on. But no, there's stuff underneath. We're going to drill out the world's core because that's what we've maybe done before. They're going to try and get at the magma and irradiate it. Have you noticed though that this show called The Dominators, and I hope that that's actually the racial description of these guys, and that's what they do. They conquered 10 galaxies, which is not bad for a lot of jilly moles.
I quite like that they seem to be bragging, because in one episode they talk about conquering 10 galaxies and then they say they're the master of a galaxy the next episode. Yeah. And when they say 10 galaxies, they're talking to the Dolcians, and when they say one galaxy, they're talking to each other. So it's like, obviously, yeah, we say this to impress people.
In the 60s, galaxy, because Terry Nation's notorious for this, but it seems that people were not so familiar with the correct terminology. And yes, galaxy and solar system were kind of interchangeable.
Or constellation.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, exactly. It's just, which is actually an arrangement seen from here of stars in space. Yes. Constellation is your interpretation. But, yeah, these boys are kind of, one in ten, it's just a decimal point, isn't it? What's that between friends? Oh, what is it about the Dominators that is slightly interesting? Yeah, okay, there's a race of blokes. Do they have wives? They never see any women. And what would they be called?
Rago
Dominatrixes.
I think the two of them are married, Toba and Rago.
I don't think there's any females in their race.
No, they bicker like a married couple. You know, they fight over things and stuff. You know, I think
the women are either inside their robots that we'll get to, but I actually think the females of their species are the Dravens. And that's what's going on. They've got Dominators and Dravens going, hate you. No, I hate you more, I hate you.
Well, that would be why the Dravens kill their males. Yeah. They're of no use at all.
It's totally proven in this story. And you see, like, all bitter and incriminating divorces, the Draven's got the crap spaceships. And these boys got the Wizzo. Even the Doctor says, this is terribly advanced and really quite good. And it is. It's a really, really super-duper space set thing. They also have robots.
Oh.
And these robots, dear listener, were going to be the big-o, wacko, money-making thing after the Daleks that we don't know anymore.
That's what we're fighting about, isn't it?
And what are they? Okay, they're meant to be terribly terrifying, because like Chumblies, they're actually little schoolboys inside robot suits, so they could be small. But their voices are also like small children in a Japanese advert.
Who is it? Sheila Dunn?
I believe Sheila Dunn, wife of Dougie Canfield, provides the
voice. Wow.
Noises. It's through a vocoder.
So yeah. Sheila Dunn will do, she'll be the receptionist next story in the
Invasion, which is directed by Dougie.
Petra, again, directed by Dougie.
And she's great in Inferno.
She's fabulous, so she does the voices. But essentially,
actually,
it's a top of fame.
Completely wrong.
Oh, really?
It's Sheila Gill.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't have thought it was because she didn't do it. But anyway, these things are 4 foot. They're painted green, it's a British Racing green.
It's a Toclophane nailed to a shoe.
It is really, with green macaroni on their heads and Christmas decorations. They're actually Minecraft-designed Christmas decorations. They've got, they're meant to be like a battery box, and they're unbelievably powerful, but they're also largely pants.
Well, they keep running out of power. It's like, we mustn't use the quarks to do anything.
I like the way they recharge by flapping their arms.
Yeah, that's right. But they're going to run out of battery, so we can't use them for anything. I mean, it really is
just... Look, however, I still side with the invaders because the Dolkians, are so bloody pants, old blokes in frocks saying, you know what this is about? Okay, it's like old folk being ineffectual. Why this story is so freaking embarrassing even at the time is really interesting. This is the only probably interesting thing for me about this story. Do you remember appeasement? And we've talked about Neville Chamberlain in the 30s, who at this time was seen as, you know, if Britain hadn't gone to war, you know, the whole of Europe would have fallen. Yeah, but that's not how people saw it. At the time, it was, if we have another war, we remember the last one, it will destroy everything. Now, in 1938, when Chamberlain was still organising, was it the Munich Agreement? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That actually allowed British sea power to build up. If they'd gone to war a year before, when Germany was at its first stage of expansionism in 1938, they would have lost the war, America would not have even noticed, and by 1940-41, Europe would have been a completely different map.
So you're saying it's mocking appeasement?
Well, I'm just going to get to that, because this point, we've got the same mirror with Vietnam.
Yeah.
We've got the Vietnam War, and the only reason that people are opposing that, as we've discussed before, it's on the telly, you can see it.
Yeah.
Now, Mervyn Haseman and Henry Lincoln, I'm not stretching a bow, because they've been interviewed in Doctor Who Monthly back in the day. They were actually against appeasement, and they were for the domino effect, which you remember is the Lyndon Baines Johnson thing of if one country falls to communism, the rest of the Pacific will fall, and then so shall we. We've had the Bay of Pigs, we've got Cuba, this is just going to escalate. These boys were actually saying, haven't you noticed that the hippies are all just drugged out and wearing hideous, terrible clothes, mismatched fibres? Very Leviticum. So the whole point of this is to say that we should actually oppose what's happening in Europe is, you know, Czechoslovakia, you know, Prague had fallen to Russia. But then after that, between the writing of this story and the stuff that we were getting on the news, this just looked really embarrassing.
Yeah, it's a viciously right-wing anti-Vietnam thing. And it fortunately...
Pro-Vietnam War thing.
Anti-Vietnam. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So 1968 is the absolute height of, like, anti-Vietnam.
Yeah, the Tet Offensive we'd seen.
Yeah. And so there's a few ways they try and twist it. Firstly, like, the Dulcians are pacifists, and he presents them as being completely decadent and completely worthless.
Yeah.
Their computers are designed so they don't even have to bother to press the buttons on it. They just sort of wave their hands effectively about it. The Dulcians have them, not the Dulcians, the Dominators have the Dulcians lifting styrofoam rocks as part of the mining effort.
It's meant to be the major effect shot that episode.
They're too weak and ineffective to do that properly, and they all sort of collapse. So everyone's completely decadent and worthless, and everyone's wearing a dress. And, you know, so the idea of a society that has advanced beyond the need for war or weapons, that's sort of viciously lampooned by the writers and seen in a completely negative light. But it's just done so incompetently, and fortunately it's been kind of eviscerated by the script editor, which is why they pulled their names off it. So it doesn't end up being quite as offensive as it should be, and it's just sort of merely bad. But it is really nasty and mean-spirited, and it undermines itself because the Dominators, who managed to defeat the Dulcians by using violence, are villains, you know, like it just stupidly fails to work as an allegory because they're villains. But it is just, it's ridiculously nasty.
How it needed to be done was we shouldn't have had a decadent peaceful culture. We should have had a peaceful culture and had that established for a full episode and actually been going, yeah, you know, we want to live here, this place looks great, and then have it attacked. And it should have been about the morality of you must fight for what you believe in when it is threatened.
The Daleks has that scene where Ian goads the Thals into fighting.
Yeah.
And it is sort of slightly problematic and, you know, like it is a little bit of a worry, but, you know, the Thals have it in them to fight. But the Dulcians are just awfully, horribly wet.
Yes.
And, you know, like, maybe they thought they were being funny or subversive by having the hippies be old people and the rebellious young Cully, who is...
young.
Well, he's
inverted commas.
He's 34, so is that young?
Well,
I would say yes, you might not say that. He actually, Cully, who's played by Arthur Cox, will actually appear 42 years later in the 11th hour.
Yes.
And it'll be his car that Amy Pond slams the Doctor's tie in the door of. And so he does come back.
Interesting sort of point there. Note that the Doctor then goes for a bow tie, which can't be slammed
in. Which can't be slammed at all. But he's sort of the fat and balding sort of rebel without a cause. But he thinks that they should be fighting. Zoe thinks they should be fighting. Jamie thinks they should be fighting. The Doctor thinks they should be fighting. Like, in every case, the Dulcians are being portrayed as you know, unrealistic and ineffectual and you know, like no match for this sort of terrible threat posed by Mr. and Mrs. Rago, two evil Terminators.
You know, this is the one where Paddy quit, don't you? Remember the story of the huge blow up? The huge Barney on the set. He wasn't really coping with it. And this is all from Derek Sherwin, who said that, you know, all Paddy did was moan, moan, moan. This is Sherwin. And he said, you know, and I'm quoting directly, Sherwin would say, you know, he'd make complaints about scripts and dialogue, and I'd say to him, look, Patrick, I'm an actor, you're an actor. If I don't like dialogue, I change it. But, you know, that Patrick was, you know, was exhausted, and as we're saying, 40, you just didn't have the time to go through the lovely rep experience of being able to have all of that rehearsal. Anyway, Sherwin adds, it got to the state where there was a huge bust up on the studio floor, and they were recording when recording stopped, which you just never did in those days. And Patrick called out, Peter, come down here now. There was this god awful confrontation between Bryant and Troughton. Everybody in the studio could hear it, and Patrick finally said, I'm resigning, I'm going. And Peter Bryant said, no, you're not, I'm firing you. And that was it. That was the end. But he said, this is enough, 42 bloody half-hour shows and you're killing me. So that was it, yeah. And they wrote it off, and it's kind of, I can get why that would have happened in this story.
It really is awful. Look, I think by the end of it, it becomes fairly generic, and it's about stopping the Dominators blowing up their bomb and all of that. And that's all right. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of okay. But gee whiz, it's a slog up to land.
And you know what? It undoes a lot of the very careful work from the previous season. You know, in the previous season, we slowly had women's parts being built up to be much, much stronger. You know, you look at Betty Caftan compared to Anne Travers.
She had very strong women's parts.
Yeah. But you compare her to Anne Travers or Tanya Lernoff, who are sort of shaded characters with different motivations, whereas Betty Caftan, as well as she was played, was just written as an ethnic villain.
Yeah.
You know, and you compare that to this, you've got one guest female character, Kando, who's a bit wet.
Well, she's virtually an Eloy, isn't she?
Yeah. I mean, and also, the Dulcians are presented as wet and effete, and what's the visual shorthand for that? They're wearing dresses.
Yeah, and they were the hippies. And the hippies were, you know, we've seen them as being all cute and counterculture and all the rest of it. At the time, they were noisome and missing the point.
And interestingly enough, as soon as Zoe needs to get changed into something, oh, well, you need to fit in, so you must wear a dress as well. You can't be wearing those space trousers.
Yeah. This show's not just pro-colonial, it's pro-imperial.
Yeah, yeah. It's
bloody awful. We've never said that before.
No, yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. The production office have forgotten that, yeah, okay, they're making Doctor Who for kids, and they're making Doctor Who for family, but one of Doctor Who's biggest audiences was and remains the late teens, early 20s students.
Yeah.
Well, not in this one. I think, what were the ratings on this one? It didn't do all that well, did it?
Well, I'm not surprised, because, you know, all those students watching would have gone, hold on, they're taking the mick out of us.
Yeah.
It's such a shame it's still in the archives. It really is. Oh, hang on, it was getting around 6 million, and gosh, 7.5 million for the second last episode.
Really?
Well, what do we know?
So yeah, people loved it.
Just before we...
It does feel very Trek, though, for something that came out before. You remember that episode, Beautiful People? It's sort of like that.
It was like The Savages. Hang on,
that was the opening. That was the working title of this one. Mm. But there were all those awful, second-season Trek episodes.
It is that thing where the society or the whole situation is set up to deliver a moral lesson in the way that The Savages was. And it did remind me of The Savages, except it's not good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The Savages, everyone learns an important lesson. The Dominators, no one learns anything. Pretty much the Doctor spends 3 or 4 episodes trying to convince the Dulcians, you must fight for yourselves, and then says, oh, bloody, I'll do it myself, and then buggers off.
Now, can I give a Latin lesson at this point? Because I've been longing to do this. So the planet Dulcis, that's the word for sweet in Latin.
Dulce.
And so the like dulce in Italian. And so the Dulcians, that's why it changes from a K to a C, because Latin didn't have K, blah, 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 blah. And then the leader, Cully's father, is called Senex, which just every schoolboy in the audience and schoolgirl would have known meant old man. And then his second in command, who's like sort of, you know, will do anything that he's told and all of that sort of thing, is called Bovem, which means ox. So, I hope that increases your enjoyment and appreciation of this story.
It doesn't, but it was a valiant effort. doesn't Cully also have a Latin origin?
No, can we leave
it?
let's just take off from Dulcis. The volcano's exploding around us, so it's time to have our brains drained as if they weren't already by this piece of drink with the mind robber.
So that starts with like a kind of reprise where the volcano is going off, and because we
made
a phone, we have the BBC phone machine here. But we had seen that in 1986, but we had no idea like what had happened or anything like that.
Exactly, and that's why for an Australian fan, The Dominators is doubly disappointing, because it has this mythic status of how did we get to this volcanic eruption? By the most dull and insulting method possible.
That's the answer. Richard the Mind Robber.
Mind Robber's a whole other story and a whole other set of ways. We'll go back to Derek Sherwin, who was saying he hand chose Peter Ling for his other writing work, Peter Ling being the writing of the story, and Peter said, look, Ling said, I'm not a science fiction writer. I've seen Doctor Who. That's not what I do. And he said, no, you're a good writer. You write about fables and narrative and people. You write about stories. This Doctor Who is a children's show fundamentally and foremost. And we kind of forget that now. But that's how it was still being pitched in the 60s. He said, I want you to write the story that you would write if you were writing for children. And don't think about SF. Think about Doctor Who as the opening up of children's imaginations, much as they open up a book. And he took it literally. So he went and referenced lots of other children's books and children's characters, and there's lots of Edith Nesbit. The children in this are, I keep going back to Edith Nesbit, but they're the five kids from Five Children and Ed. So they end up in this space. But what's the best thing about this story? It was written for four episodes and produced for four episodes. But you don't get that. You get a beautiful point of an extra episode of the top of it, because they cut out one of the Dominators because they just couldn't add it any further. So we get an extra story with no budget, no script, and no supporting cast. All you've got are the three leads, the TARDIS set, and whatever else you can scrounge around. So Sherwin went home and he said in the space of 48 hours, wrote it. You can kind of believe it. I wonder if George Lucas saw this before he made THX 1138, because what you end up with is something that's really hoopy and post-David Bowie, you end up with a white cyclorama on a void set. Isn't really something, as far as I can tell, that people did back then. It was just a pretty bold thing. You might have got it in pop video stuff, but even then you'd have something spangly hanging that, you know, Dusty could swoon around in front of. You haven't. This is a super white set of a super void of, in the same way that we had a universe that should have been like this with Celestial Toymaker, the TARDIS has to jump outside of time and space. And it's the only time in this incarnation that you see the Doctor really worried about doing something like this with the TARDIS. He's actually quite disturbed about having to flick this switch and take us out of the known universe, because he knows what monsters be there.
So this is part of what eventually becomes a sort of occasional tradition, isn't it, in Doctor Who? And it does start with the Celestial Toymaker, but not very auspiciously.
Not very well.
And you can see Celestial Toymaker does the sort of iconography of the children's, like of Victorian children's games and Victorian children's literature. It has the, the King and Queen playing cards from Alice in Wonderland and that sort of thing, you know. So it's kind of like a rehearsal for that. There's something smarter about this.
Much and smarter. There's levels in this one.
Yeah, and it does have a proper plot. Whereas Celestial Toymaker was sort of clearly marking time. It is, really remarkably similar. And I guess, what would you say the analogues for it were? It doesn't really come up again in Pertwee, but Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Yeah, very much so.
Which is also about fictionality and stuff.
There is. It's Greatest Show in the Galaxy, I was going to say, The Three Doctors.
Oh, okay.
When you've got the whole idea of the Void universe and that William Blakeian style of there being a fictional universe beyond our universe.
Yeah.
It's very much Remembrance of the Daleks when we finally get to the master of the land of fiction, who's actually, turns out, the bloke running this realm, turns out to be an old writer who himself wrote comics based on the real person. The master, it's lovely to think that it presages the real master, but Paddy's reactions aren't exactly what you would expect when he first... Although he says master when you first hear it. But no, it's an old bloke based on a man called Frank Richards, who was actually Charles Hamilton, who wrote the magnet comic Billy Bunter, who of course is... Cyril, the fat kid in Terrible, which I can't say, so let's talk to a maker without
Other
thing. Oh, look, this lovely thing. Okay, you've got three doctors. I think he's actually Jasmine Brakes. Just in the same way that in Remembrance of the Daleks, you've got the little blonde kid under the industrial motorcycle hairdryer. You've got the master in his little skull cap in this one.
If you're interested in the Frank Richards thing, he wrote, you remember the master says that he wrote like 5,000 words a week for like 20 years or something, or, you know, and it's some extraordinary amount of words that he wrote. There is a really, really interesting and clever analysis of his writing by George Orwell, like in an essay.
Frank Richards writing.
Yeah. In an essay called Boys Weeklies from 1940. And Orwell assumes that because these stories about Greyfriars, I think it's called Greyfriars, is the name of the school or something like that, I can't remember, but the Billy Bunter stories, he just thinks that there are so many and the style is so sort of generic and it's been going for so many decades. He just assumes that it's a pseudonym for a whole bunch of different writers who are writing in a particular style. Uh-huh. And he actually corrects himself in a footnote to say, no, this guy is just writing and writing and writing for, like, literally decades. He wrote in the Magnet magazine from 1908 to 1940.
Yeah.
And just a story every week.
And Peter Ling had a similar career, and you can see this is a real little nod to how awful it is to have to be a hack writer. So in the same way.
Churning out these things.
But I want to talk also about the universe where this occurs, because this is actually interesting. Have you noticed that it could actually be a construct either of the Eternals or the Gods of Ragnarok, or it could actually be a Tharil construct, because you've got the same white void where imagination and ideas... You've got the same white void where imagination and ideas construct the world, just as you do in Warrior's Gate.
In fact, I think that there is something slightly 60s and disappointing about this, in that it's revealed to be a megalomaniacal computer in charge of it, and the computer has
control rooms.
It is, but it's like the great intelligence has to have a control room as well.
But the thing is, it's playing with the 60s idea. Yes, it has to be a computer because this is 60s and because that's what 60s fiction
does. And that's what James Bond does, you know, and that's what the big films do, yeah.
Yes, villains are German and muscle-bound and have disintegrator rays and costumes that look like skeletons. Yes, Rapunzel's a flirt because she's waiting for a prince. Yes, robots are ill-defined and based on childhood fears. This is one I absolutely love. Rod hates it.
Really? I think folk... This is the point. It's
totally.
I want to say metalepsis. It's one of those things. It's one of those stories. It's not so much about itself. It's about what it's about.
Yes.
It's a thing about other things, and it's interesting. But if you look at it just straight on, it probably isn't that exciting or interesting. For Doctor Who fans, it's really interesting.
Exactly.
I remember being shocked by how cheap it looked, because it was the first 60s Doctor Who I ever saw.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I remember being horrified.
It was the first 60s black and white Doctor Who I ever saw.
Yeah.
Because as a child, I didn't like watching black and white television.
No.
Yeah, well, until you can both leave the room. I thought it was fantastic when I first saw it in 86.
Oh, I still do.
And I liked it because it was tripping at all of those other things.
Yeah.
And it's got Christopher Robbie with his hands on his hips. Excellent. You know, he's going to be our cyber controller. He's always doing the same kind of thing. And looking pretty well smashing in his little tightsies and rubber drippy outfit. And he gets thrown around by Wendy Padbury and Peele later on, which is, again, lampooning a whole other thing. It does every show and every story.
And Wendy actually does a really good job with it.
She only had a week's training.
She said I was quite nervous, but Christopher threw himself around. It was wonderful.
So many stories in that one, aren't there?
It's such a joyful experience after the Dominators, because even though the plot may be scarce and repetitive,
yeah.
it's Doctor Who having fun again.
Yeah, and after the previous year, too, where it wasn't... It had stopped adventuring, and it had stopped doing things that it hadn't tried before. Mm. This is really an incredible breath of fresh air.
And it's real weird.
Yeah.
Real weird. And that first story, you really don't know what's going on in the TARDIS. You know, it was originally shot as Jamie and Zoe and the console just flicker out of existence from the console room, and Patrick was meant to be lying there in a comatose state, but they considered that to be too frightening. I think apparently they shot it, but they thought it was too frightening for the children at home. I don't see why. It would have been amazing.
It's pretty amazing what we have.
The TARDIS appears to disappear. What I like is that you can see this story as like an episode of The Prisoner, really, which by now had been seen, of all of this is actually happening in the characters' imaginations. And really, very rarely, it is, because the Clockwork Soldiers, Jamie doesn't contribute much, but they're obviously redcoats.
Yeah.
And they're obviously another play on Cybermen. He's constantly having to revisit that notion. Zoe, obviously, with the carcass, that's from her childhood, from the year 2000. but it's fair enough to say that that was an old comic being rebroadcast. Yeah. Patrick doesn't know. Where does the Doctor's fantasy thing slip in? Well, of course, he knows Gulliver back to front, you said.
Those are things that kids are going to be aware of. You know what I mean? That, like, Gulliver, again, did I mention that Jonathan Swift is in my enemies list?
Yes, you did.
Like, Gulliver, you know, was a perennial kid's favourite, you know, Rapunzel. Mm. So there's reference to Little Women.
There's an extract read from the beginning of that.
We've got all those stories.
Greek mythology, stuff you do at school, you know.
It's the first bit of stop-motion, proper animation. Oh, it's the first John Friedlander stopped in this one. The Medusa head and the movie Wavy Snakes are by John Friedlander, who later gave us Davros and a whole lot of other groovy draconian things.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's his first work. And it looks great. Because, you know, Harryhausen was doing all those super Voyage of Tom Baker stories. So, this thing. It's great because it's what Celestial Toymaker should have been. And it's not... Yes. It doesn't totally get there, of course, but it's so much better than what it could have been.
Oh, yeah.
It's also the first appearance of Sir Bernard Horsfall.
Yes, as Gulliver.
He should be.
Well, he's
points taken off for... is he in Diamonds Are Forever?
Yeah, everything awful is Diamonds Are Forever. No, it's Diamonds Are Forever.
No, that's right. It's friend of the podcast, Gary Russell, who's an octopus.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, he does get points off for appearing in that. But he is pretty good in this, with his sort of northern accent and his weird way of
saying
it. It's from Nottingham. It's so fun. It's really fun. I really like him. He's terrific. He appears as several Time Lords, and I think later this year, in fact, won't he sentence the Doctor to exile?
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Getting ahead
sentence you to be John Pertwee.
Yes. That is cruel, isn't it? No. They should have something in their constitution.
Be John Pertwee, or you can be Chubby Checker.
Or Matt Smith. We didn't see all the other drawings they threw up, did we?
No.
Can we mention Hamish Wilson?
Oh, of course, yeah. For those of you who don't know out there, dear listeners, just before recording episode 2, Fraser Hines, on the Monday of rehearsals, was diagnosed with chickenpox.
Well, that's what he tells everyone.
that's what Derek Sherwood says as well, and all sorts of other people. Sure. But his doctor said, no, you can't be near anyone. You have to put yourself in quarantine. And this was getting towards the end of the production block. This was actually the last thing recorded in the production block, so they couldn't delay recording. The decision was made, hold on, we're in a story where things can just pop in and out of existence. Yeah. Brilliant.
So you get a whole other actor doing that.
He's really good. He's from Glasgow. He's Glaswegian. He describes on the making of, you know, one of the challenges was, I'm Glaswegian, but Fraser does an Edinburgh accent. And so I sounded nothing like him, and I felt very bad about that. It's like the Scotsman saying, my accent wasn't good enough for the Englishman pretending to be Scottish.
There is a scene, actually, where he calls out, and the Doctor just thinks it's Jamie, even though it sounds nothing like him.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also quite amused by the fact that every time Wendy Padbury talks about it, it says, would have liked to keep Hamish, actually. Didn't need to change him back. We didn't need Fraser.
She's cruel, isn't she?
Well, she also would have got to keep her pants on.
he didn't pants Wendy, did he?
I think this might have actually been the story where during rehearsal Wendy fell asleep. And she was wearing a skirt that had clasps on the side, and they undid the clasps and said, "Wake up, Patters, it's time for your scene." And she jumped up and ran out of the waiting room wearing only her knickers, and who should walk in but the vicar? Because they would rehearse in an old church hall, and she curtsied and said, "Good morning, vicar," and ran back to get her skirt.
That's delightful. That's
the 60s in a box, isn't it? Really, it's where it's always been. So, it's worth watching for the things that it does.
I mean, even though it's playing with the, and this is the first time I'm going to use this word in I think about five podcasts, it's playing with the tropes of Doctor Who itself. Even though it is, I do think, you know, at the end where it's suddenly, "And we're going to invade Earth! Man will become like a string of sausages." That was one of Rod's big problems, and it is kind of a thing.
Well, that's what pissed me off with otherwise amazing Power of Three. And I love that story with, with Matt Smith with the father and son
team. Yeah, yeah.
Rory and Mark playing his dad Brian. It was such a great story, and they ended up like finishing up every bloody story of Voyager. We just end up on an alien bridge, and it's an invasion or some sort of other planet.
It's a real Voyager alien. Yeah, well, that's what I was saying before. It is like I still think, you know, when it comes to Greatest Show in the Galaxy, it will be caused by gods and magic stones and that kind of thing.
Much more fun.
Here there has to be sort of some crummy science fiction thing, and there has to be some threat to Earth. And it's the same as the Abominable Snowman, which is Abominable Snowman and the Yeti, where it's a disembodied intelligence that can possess people and do anything, but it feels compelled to make them make fab 60s futuristic control rooms. And it is, there is a kind of only narrow range within which Doctor Who operates in this era.
Yeah.
And the Mind Robber does a far, far better job than most of escaping from that range, but just the dead weight of science fiction kind of pulls it back to be a particular sort of thing towards the end.
Absolutely, and it feels so strange simply because Earth has not really been involved until this point.
Yeah.
Except, you know, all the fiction comes from Earth, which is understandable. But, yeah, Earth hasn't even been involved, and then suddenly we're going to invade Earth to use the power of man's imagination. It's like, well, that's completely at variance with what's happened before. Rod described it as, we have five episodes of padding, followed by we're going to invade Earth because why not?
Yeah, no, I can see how that would, and that's pretty similar to my assessment of Celestial Toymaker, that is just wall-to-wall padding without even the invasion of Earth. But I think this one has a sort of structure and a quest structure and stuff. It does seem to be better structured.
Oh, yeah, I think it's actually got a plot, and it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it does repeat the sort of constant, a fictional character, we have to say they don't exist, but it still has development.
Yeah.
Whereas the repetition of having to go through various tasks in Celestial Toymaker just feels like we need to fill three episodes.
I just had a memory, like a flashback of that stupid story and the rhymes and everything. Goodness, that's awful. I'll never recover. Never, I tell you.
Anything else on...
No, I've already passed on.
Right, so...
Go and read Five Children and It. If you want to get this story, go and read. And don't listen to him, because Gulliver's Travels actually has really interesting satire and political comedy at that time.
But he's on the...
And I like his prose style.
I enjoy the book enormously, but there's a middle bit where it's a floating island full of scientists, and Swift, who is a clergyman, mocks the scientists. And, all his satire is about science. And you kind of think, sweetheart, you are massively on the losing side of this battle.
But scientists at the time are also jumping in on the whole... In fact, David Whittaker's an 18th century scientist, because it's all alchemy and woo-woo. There's a lot of nutty stuff. But he also... The Yahoos, these primitive, appalling... What's the quote? I've written it down. I looked it up.
Pawsies.
The Yahoos were disgusting, primitive criminals ruled over by an equine governance of horses. It's the British royal family. The Yahoos of Princess Anne.
No, it's the other way around.
Okay, well, I mean, it's all one culture. But we're the Yahoos and the royal family ruling us. How awful. I think there's lots in Swift. It's just like there's lots in the story. But you've got to look. It's the way I like watching this show. It's not what it is. It's what it references and what you can find in it. Mm. It's not it itself. It's once you go under the surface.
Yeah. Oh, no, no. It's a good book. I'll admit this show.
So bye-bye, Mind Robert. It's been lovely.
Bye-bye. And bye-bye, Production Block 5.
Yeah.
We head on
Let the door hit your arse on the way.
Into the last production block of the 1960s with The Invasion.
Now, this is really good. Isn't it nice to have Struth, this is good. And I love this. I love the animated version. I love... was it Ian Martin who wrote the Target novel?
Yes.
Because that's a ripper, boys and girls. And this is a ripper. And the animation version, I love every version of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I was so chuffed that I got this.
Yeah, you noticed that. Yeah.
We'll talk over it.
Yeah.
He needs this. He's getting a word in edgeways.
Now, the weird thing is, of course... Doctor Who stories that go over four parts, more often than not, are hideously padded.
No, tiresome, I think.
Hideously tiresome. The Invasion manages to escape that really by being two four-parters that are put together. So episodes 1 to 4 are all about setting up the mystery of Tobias Vaughan, re-establishing the Brigadier, introducing a unit, and giving us the first modern-day story in... a city environment since the Faceless Ones. You know, we did have the modern-day story of Fury from the Deep, but that could have been set 100 years in the future.
I think it kind of was. I mean, why do oil guard people all have guns and sort of space helmets?
Exactly. But, yeah, we do have this possibly slightly future environment. There's nothing in the script to specify it, but they have video phones, collarless shirts are quite common. You know, you've got a military base inside a Hercules jet, and the BBC continuity announcer said it was 1975. So...
No, I think it's later than that. I think... Oh. Don't they say they say it's 4 years after the Yeti. And I think the Yeti, and we aren't going to fight over this, is set in 1975.
Which would make this
visually definitely.
Yeah. Well, as usual, it's always set in the actual year. Mm. But Jamie says that it's only been a few weeks for him since the Yeti, but the Brigadier says it's been 4 years. So it is near future, like it's sort of 10 years in the future or something like that.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, if you were to say that Where the Fear was set in... the year it was broadcast, 1967.
Yeah.
Then 4 years later would be 1971. And the implication later on in Spearhead is that not much time, certainly no longer than a year, has passed since the invasion for the Brigadier. So that's possible, but we'll get into unit dating later.
No, let's not. I can't possibly put any energy into caring about that at all.
When I say later, remember, I'm coming back to unit dating with a certain Tom Baker story. Foreshadowing, dear listener, foreshadowing. It's a game of two halves, very wisely, because, you know, when you've got this sort of huge eight-part iceberg in the middle of your thing, you can really sort of handle that in two ways. You can do what John Wiles did with the Dalek Master Plan and say, I don't want to make this anyway, so let's get on with it and do it by the numbers. Or you can do what Derek Sherwin did and say, right, I'm developing an idea, I'm giving it to some very talented writers, and we are going to go for broke. And I think a big reason that they go for broke is this is the 5th anniversary special of Doctor
Who. Oh, really? You think so?
Episode 4... was broadcast on the 23rd of November, 1968.
Wow.
Isn't that lovely? You and know why, though? This is a Dougie Canfield directed story.
Oh, look at it.
It's a Derek Sherwin writing it finally, so we get we get Doctor Who as it's meant to be by this production team.
So they pull out all the stops. You've got Derek Sherwin, you've got Dougie Canfield.
We've got a score. What about this score? You know, we've mentioned before John Barry's score for the Ipcress Files. If you ever watch that movie again, it's the same music. It's as close as you can get without getting, sued for it. I love the sound of this thing.
They bring back a returning monster in the form of the Cybermen who don't appear until the anniversary
because
episode.
Because they're a little bit of rubbish, they stay in boxes for the first four episodes because they're just, they're unfurry yetis, which is what they should be. They're just ciphers for the real villain, who is, drumroll, the campest thing of the 60s we've ever had.
Yes,
and it's magic, again, isn't it?
Yes. It's magic, Mavic Chen.
Yeah, and you know, the best villain actors playing Doctor Who, aside from Patrick Troughton, playing Tobias Vaughn.
Yeah, he's really, I mean,
so he's back, the Brigadier.
And who is
back.
This guy, Tobias Vaughn? What's his... What's his motivation?
His motivation, his family were killed in a car crash. Just as initials are off. And, of course, he has his wonderful henchman
pack.
He's fudge to his mates. He's actually... Tobias Vaughn's motivation is the whole Rupert Murdoch thing. He just wants power over media. That's why he's such a great villain. It's really just the whole narrative thing of his own narcissistic will for control. And he's as camp as a pair of udders in a really crowded field from episode one.
But he's
she's wonderful.
Importantly, he's camp, but still manages to be menacing.
You're saying camp isn't menacing?
Well, the thing is, if you
look at Graham Norton, he's terrible.
If you look at 60s Batman, you get camp, but you don't really get menacing.
Yeah,
from the Joker,
a whole other thing.
You know?
Yeah, we might segue, actually, because the Blu-ray box set of Adam West Batman's about to come out. So we'll have watched a few by the time I'm getting it. We'll watch a few when we get to the end of the season.
Yeah, I've actually bought it for Rod for Christmas, and he doesn't listen to the podcast, so no, that's fine.
It really is an extraordinary performance, and it does look, in a way, like they're trying to remake Dalek Master Plan. They don't have the Daleks anymore, but they have the Cybermen.
Mm.
And they bring Tobias Vaughn because he's done such a Tobias Vaughn, Kevin Stoney, as a great...
He cannot escape this character.
villain, like such a spectacularly great villain. And the performance is really, really remarkable. So there are times where he just seems absolutely powerful and in control. There's that fantastic scene early on where Isabel, who we just have to talk about in a minute...
Because she's not interested.
She's wonderful. No. And we'll talk about... This is another reason to hate Norman Ashby, like Haseman and Lincoln, who refused again to give the rights to the Travers characters.
Oh, is that why we don't have them?
So that's why they're not in it.
I mean, they did look into it, and Jack Watling wasn't available anyway.
But
you're right, that they couldn't use the characters even if they wanted to.
For
they
sure.
did manage to wrangle Lethbridge Stewart, though.
Yeah, that's true.
And
that's because Sherwin actually, and maintains to this day, Derek Sherwin is quite vocal about he's now re-suing the BBC and has been doing so for over 20 years because he says he invented UNIT.
He's crazy.
Well, but he was a freelance writer when he wrote... was it Web of Fear? He was a freelancer when he... I know he didn't write Web of Fear, but he still claims he invented UNIT. He did. He created UNIT on top of the original screwdriver.
Yeah, Vic Semberton isn't too happy about the fact that the sonic screwdriver is so heavily marketed.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, when they break into International Electromatics, which is his company, when they break in sort of episode two because Zoe speaks to a computer in Algol and makes its brain explode.
Oh, yeah, Zoe
and then
stuff.
You
try doing that to your Mac.
But Mac isn't very good at Algol, and neither am I. But I do at least know how to pronounce the word integer, unlike Zoe.
Yeah.
He's laughing, and like it's not sort of "wah-ha-ha, evil villain" laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like genuinely amused, and he does it quite a lot. Mm. And there's one utterly terrifying scene where Isabel Watkins, so Professor Watkins, who is being kept captive, and he says, "You know, you're an evil man, and all of that sort of thing, and I would, you know, destroy you," and he gives him a gun
to shoot him with.
And he's so amused and he's so wonderful. And then he'll turn on a dime and he'll be screaming and stuff. And he's really terrifying and, like, really in control.
He's too old with too much power.
He's wonderful, though. It is such an amazing performance.
Yeah, it almost feels like in the new series, in the Sontaran Stratagem, they were kind of trying to go down a similar route with the Luke Rattigan character, you know, the smartest man in the room.
Yeah, that's true.
He doesn't quite pull it off because he doesn't... I suppose it's a matter of age. You know, you couldn't believe a young man playing the Kevin Stoney part, playing Tobias Vaughn.
Well, you wouldn't get away with it.
No.
I reckon you could. Like, it could be, like, a young... Because he just needs to be, like, a tech startup kind of guy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is, it's just the variety of the performance and things. It's so wonderful. Yeah.
And what's so glorious as well is Kevin Stoney is, he's a tall man, he's got that shock of white hair, he's immaculately dressed, and they pit him against Troughton, who is small, clothed too big for it,
dark hair,
dressed like a tramp, dark hair, and it becomes a battle of the minds.
Yeah.
And right from the beginning, at first, Packer's like, oh, God, you know, who are those two? Who are those two scruffy-looking pair? And Vaughn's just like, no, he's a danger. Our allies know him, Packer. Also, he's one of the most fun villains to do the voice for.
What about the cyber thing behind the wall? That has Peter Halliday doing sort of like a funny...
I recognise him from Planet 14.
Yeah, what the hell is Planet 14?
Well, who knows?
Well, according to Doctor Who magazine and their comic strip, Planet 14 is Marinus.
Or the moon.
Marinus.
Yeah, it's a whole sixth Doctor segue to try and make
the board becomes
out.
Cybermen.
That was the world shapers. Yeah. That was Grant Morrison, of all people.
Oh, I think I've heard of
Grant Morrison. Yeah.
This is actually the moment where they stop caring about the Cybermen's origins in a way. Mm. Maybe they've done that before that, but you know, like 1986, they arrive. 2070, it's the moon base, and everyone kind of remembers them. God knows when Wheel of Space is set. Like, who knows? God,
I believe it is the 21st century.
People say that, but it's not actually said anywhere. and no one's heard of the Cybermen there. And then there's the Tomb of Cybermen, which is sort of the far future. But there's a sense in which the Cybermen are from the future. They're from sort of 30 years
Yeah, because chronologically,
future.
This is the earliest we've seen Cybermen.
Yeah. So somehow they're back in, like, and they've heard of the Doctor.
Yeah.
So who must have had an earlier... So I just don't think we care anymore. And there is a sense in which the show has done that again. When Russell reintroduces the Cybermen, he does it in a great way by having them from a parallel world rather than from... Like a parallel universe rather than Earth's mysterious twin planet. And so they're invented in sort of 2006, essentially.
Yes.
And every subsequent reappearance in Russell's era... There is an explanation for why they're there, even when they appear in the past in The Next Doctor. But since then, we don't care, and they can appear at any space or time. And they landed their spaceship, you know, centuries ago in closing time. And that shouldn't be possible, but we've stopped caring.
Exactly. It's how they got there is less important than the fact they are there. And I think the Cybermen sort of being strong, silent heavies in this is far more effective than it was in The Wheel in Space. And I think, again, that's partially due to the use of Tobias Vaughn.
Yeah.
Because it gives them a human face, which means you can put off seeing them in that great David Whittaker tradition of prevaricating, revealing your monster, without having a nebulous threat. You've got a tangible threat in the form of Tobias Vaughn. So it doesn't matter that we don't see the Cybermen for ages. And then when we do see them... Yet they don't speak very much because they don't have to.
I think they've got two lines of dialogue, and it is again Peter Halliday.
But they are just blunt instruments in this.
Yeah.
And despite the fact they don't speak, because you've got the cyber planner being all treacherous and saying, right, we've got what we want, now we can dispose of you, the Cybermen become terrifying, arguably for the first time since the moon base.
Yeah, but in a sense they're not really terrifying because they're just a fleet of spaceships firing missiles at us, and the whole end of it is all about that.
Oh,
but all of that is so fun.
Coming out of the sewers.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's iconic, but it's difficult when we start talking about, you know, intense emotional reactions to this because we're not five, and none of us listening to this are going to be five, and we weren't five when we saw it. I wonder if we kind of wanting it to be terrifying just because we've got having an affair with this thing. Because we are, really. I mean, you do kind of elevate your partner to the point of being lovely, even for its faults that you don't really see. I'd like to think it's frightening, but I think what makes it work is actually the artfulness of the construct of it, that the way they're articulated and the way they move and come out and the way that they're held back for so long.
Yes.
Is and that, like all these great villains, you could argue that maybe the Daleks really only reach a popular core or get a second boot when they've got Davros in front of them.
Yeah.
Maybe the Cybermen only really work because they've got Tobias Vaughn in front of them. You need someone to do the gestures, to do the faces and do the accent.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to background them. Those scenes in the moon base where the Cybermen go on and on in sort of episode 4. No one wants to see that again, I think. Whereas Tobias Vaughn...
It's like listening to a printer going wrong. Hell, where's my form gun?
But you know, Tobias Vaughn just is fabulous every time he's on screen.
Yeah.
You know, you said earlier that it was like a game of two parts, but I actually wonder whether that's the case. Like, at the halfway point, we get the Cybermen, but they don't really change the focus of the story. And I was actually thinking, you know, are the Cybermen a mystery sort of thing? Because, in fact, I discovered the Radio Times says at episode 1 that this is a new Cyberman story. So everyone's waiting for the Cybermen to arrive. There's all this talk about emotions, you know, and Professor Watkins, who will later go on to have giant hair and invent Professor Kettlebell's robot. Professor Watkins is inventing a machine that creates emotions, and Vaughn says that our, and you know, like our associates or whatever he calls them, you know, are particularly vulnerable to emotion. So I don't think it's a mystery that it's the Cybermen. So it's not a big game changer. And then you get the Cybermen. Essentially, there's episode 5 when they're in the sewer. Is that right? And then episode 6. I can't remember anymore. But it is very late in the game that we get that very iconic cliffhanger. And so I don't think they're all that important to the story. What I think is that this is told at a leisurely pace, but that's tolerable because there's enough characters that we're interested in keep us going. And so we've got Isabel, who I think is a wonderful creation. Like, Anne Travers was spectacular. We have to be sorry that she didn't get a second run here. But Isabel is really funny. She's sort of... She hasn't got that much money.
She's super mod real.
Yeah,
she's you can wonderful. See her stepping out of any of the films that were going on at the time. She's kind of like a junior Julie Christie. And vulnerable, real...
Yeah, she's really lovely.
Trying to talk straight, even though she's been to a nice school.
Yeah, yeah, and she falls in love with the very straight-laced and sort of, you know, very nerdy, not nerdy, but very conservative.
Is that Captain Jimmy?
I was struggling there. So there's a Jimmy and a Jimmy.
They've always got a red shirt on there. Have you noticed how the Brit goes through his captains with alarming regularity?
Well, according to the novel Face of the Enemy,
Jimmy gets syphilis and dies.
Stop it.
According to the novel Face of the Enemy, Captain Jimmy Turner and Captain Jimmy Munro from Spearhead from Space are both alive and well in Doctor Who Series 9, and the Brigadier, in fact, goes out for drinks with them.
Oh, good, that's
happy. Which is lovely.
I just think that is really nice, that little budding romance, which is quite sweet.
Hey, are you stinking rich?
Yes! Isn't that great? All of that is so terrific.
Kind of like a smack on the back of the head, really. It's like, it was just so, you're really trying to be lingo here, you're really trying to be street. But yeah, okay, it's, at the time, it would have been fresh and surprising. I like the two girls jumping around trying to do their own version of Antonioni's blow-up. They're just missing David Hemmings, but they're both trying to be... You know the film Blow Up the same year. Oh, it's an amazing film. It's got David Hemmings as a photographer who unwittingly witnesses a murder, and it's put together from these long takes. But there's a scene. It's got an amazing soundtrack from the Yardbirds and Herbie Hancock, and it's just the film of the year. Vanessa Redgrave, David Hemmings, Penelope Tree, a whole lot of groovy models of the 60s, and it's just this scene. He's meant to be David Bailey. But yeah, they're troping that thing where, have a drink, where the girls are dressing up and doing that whole kind of lovely moddy 60s. I'll put a link to the film.
I think you get an extra drink if trope becomes a verb, actually.
It just feels fresh and now and happening, doesn't it? And of course, it's got Dougie Canfield, so 8 episodes is still a pleasure cruise.
Do you know. And I don't think we've talked that much about what it is about Canfield's direction that's so good, but I do remember all the shots are so well composed.
Yes.
And you compare it to the kind of haphazard stuff that was happening in the studio in the early 60s. Everything's really nicely composed. People, like, stand up into the frame or move into the frame. There's a wonderful thing where Tobias Vaughn has 3 round screens on the wall of his office.
Yes.
And he'll go, Packer, and Packer will, like, move into those screens from the left. Like, he'll move off camera. And then that's subverted at the very end when he calls for Packer, and a Cyberman, does exactly absolutely. The same move.
We keep talking about how wonderful Kevin Stone is and how wonderful Peter Halliday is, but as you were saying, Nathan, all of the cast are just so good in this. Mm. Everyone is giving it their all. Everyone has their own little story throughout. So much so that it wasn't until about the third or fourth time I watched this that I realised that Jamie and Professor Watkins just kind of disappear in episode 7.
Jamie gets shot when, you know, they're trying to capture Professor Watkins.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so they're put into hospital.
He's
and he
barely in the last two episodes at all. There's a filmed insert at the end where they're getting the TARDIS and go, but essentially he's absent.
But because all of the cast are so good, you don't really notice until you're made aware of it. I'm not saying that as a detriment to Fraser. I'm saying that as the conclusion to the story is so fast moving and there's so many things going on in different places that it's a way to kind of go, okay, we are missing someone. Let's make sure the audience doesn't notice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was this thing where at the end of it, I kind of felt like I was glad that I'd spent that much time with these people.
Yes.
And, you know, like, it isn't, it's only a year, it's just over a year before Spearhead from Space. And we're going to have 3 7-parters in that season.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, again, I'm not sure how successful all of those are, but there was something kind of nice. If there's enough action and enough people, like enough worthwhile characters, staying with them for 8 episodes is actually not arduous.
No, certainly not.
Many of the 6-parters last season are much harder to sit through than this.
Yeah, absolutely. And amongst those characters who are really fun to watch, we have two who will soon become regular allies, I suppose you might call them, or regular supporting characters. We've, of course, got Nicholas Courtney back, now promoted to Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart.
And that's a twist. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
And yeah, it's rather wonderful. The first time we see him in the story, he's climbing out of the cockpit. So, you know, you get an eyeful of Nicholas Courtney's rear end. And then, ta-da, I'm wearing a moustache. And, of course, sitting on the comms unit and getting people on the blow-up of the Brigadier and spying on the Doctor and Jamie in a car, Sergeant Benton, welcome John Levine in the flesh.
Well, so John Levine had been a Yeti in the Web of Fear, and he had been a Cyberman in the moon base, apparently, uncredited, and he was going to be a Cyberman in this, but Dougie Canfield sacked the original Benton.
Yes.
He kept turning up late to recording and putting their schedule out, and no one will tell us who the original Benton was. I don't think we know. Then Benton gets promoted, and Benton is in it all the way through until the android invasion is his last appearance, appearance, and he gets mentions in both Mordred Undead and Battlefield years later. So he does have a really long history of the program, and he is... it's just him and the Brigadier from 60s Unit are the only ones who survive.
And it's rather lovely, you know, considering this is effectively Doctor Who's 5th anniversary story, whether it was intended to be or not, I don't think is that important. It's rather lovely that this uses so much of Doctor Who's past. You know, the Earth is under attack, it's got Cybermen, they've brought back a villain from the Hartnell era, they've brought back Dougie Canfield, who directed Hartnell stories as well, but it has something for the future as well. It's setting up UNIT, it's bringing in Sergeant Benton.
How conscious is that?
According to Derek Sherwin, it's quite conscious that the writing was already on the wall, even for this first part of the production block, that the costs needed to be brought down for Doctor Who, but he was told very late in the day, so it's like, right, you can only turn a cruise liner so fast. We'll start turning it around.
This is the most expensive Doctor Who story to date, though, apparently.
Yeah, makes sense. But, you know, he also said he was sick of all this blithering about in space. He thought it was silly. And
so, he was pitching this idea of Earthbound stories, political thrillers. We'll have a regular cast. So even though, you know, we'll have to spend money on... We'll have to spend money on... Yeah, it's the troubleshooters. It's the concept that Sidney Newman rejected.
Yeah.
Even though we'll have to spend money on battle sequences and whatnot, we'll save money on standing sets and what have you. So it's the celebration of the last 5 years and the beginning of something quite different.
Yeah, well, it is... It could have fitted into season 7, I think. When the Pertwee era comes along quite soon, I do have many, many critical things to say about it. But one thing that I really like about it is an expanded regular cast.
Mm, yes.
And it's one of the things that both Russell and Moffat, to a lesser degree, have tried to do, so that it's not just a story about two people and everyone else is new every month, that you get to know a bunch of people. And, like, in the Pertwee era, you know, I'm not saying that Benton and Yates are particularly well-characterised or anything like that, but they are familiar faces and they do eventually become people that you're invested in. And it does, I think it helps the show enormously. And so here, where you have, you know, Jimmy and Benton and Isabel and, you know, Professor Watkins and, you know, like a whole bunch of people who are sort of, who you're reasonably invested in and who are kind of interesting enough, I think it makes the show quite, you know, quite fun to watch.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's got units based in a flying converted Hercules. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Only
yeah,
for the first and last time. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Well, they definitely Heaven did have a unit based on a plane.
Yeah, and, I think, and then we get the Valiant later on.
The Valiant.
Cloud-based.
Cloud-based. Well, I think that that is a... Like, I think that Moffat must have done a deliberate invasion reference. And that's the other thing that we haven't mentioned, is this is the definitive Cybermen story. And
yeah,
certainly when the Cybermen...
Back to.
Yeah, we're in Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel, which I think are a bit underrated, having the Cybermen a threat in contemporary London. You know, like, I think... And in International Electromatics actually get a shout-out. They're actually mentioned in it.
And this, the Cybermen marching down the steps of St Paul's has been redone twice, once for more than 30 years in the TARDIS.
And then again for...
Dark Water and Death in Heaven,
yeah.
Recently.
Well, you know where that comes from, though, don't you? We've cited it before, and it's and Canfield deliberately, you know, did it. It's shot for shot, Potemkin, Battleship Potemkin. It's the same shot used in Gilliam's Brazil, and it's used in Scorsese's Untouchables. The soldiers marching down the... It's an iconic thing long before we got there.
And coming back to something you were saying earlier, Richard, about whether this is scary or not, the reason I find that cliffhanger to episode 6 so scary when they're all marching out is you keep thinking, the music's going to cut in now, the episode's going to end, and I'm going to be safe. But no, we cut to more Cybermen, and more Cybermen, and more Cybermen. It's the equivalent of... the shot at the beginning of the first Star Wars film where the ship passes over you and it just goes on
and more and on.
And yet there's more and more and more. And then finally the music cuts in and you're safe.
Well, the credits actually scroll up them. I mean, there's Sidemen walking along past that pub there while they're closing credits.
But earlier on, you've seen that they have to...
It doesn't even stop with the music,
But earlier on, you've seen that they have to revive them one at a time. And I'm thinking, really, have they got the time to bring, you know, is there probably only about 8 of them? Because they've got to do them by hand each one. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? They just zip, zip, you know. Anyway.
Well, they're controlling the whole world through their iPods anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That does that. That's a nice thing. I don't know. I don't know why they're picking on London. It would have been sort of more sensible to actually come in from the sides and from quieter communities. But then you wouldn't have been able to do Canfield's money shots.
Tobias Vaughan is an egomaniac.
Yep, he really is.
To you, Tobias, you were fabulous.
I was going to say, much like most podcasts out there, but not like ours, I'm sure. I'm really glad we've ended this season, haven't we? Yeah, because this just went out before Christmas, didn't it? So it's nice that we're back at this point now. I was really glad that the year ends on this high.
Yeah.
Do they take a break? Like, are there a few weeks before the next story starts?
I don't think so. I think they just went
straight into the Crotons.
Yeah, I don't think they really did mid-season breaks until the 70s.
Right, okay. Mm. But they did do them in the 70s, didn't they?
Yes.
They break over Christmas.
Yeah,
They did. Right, so before we go, remember, you can always enter our competition. Just comment on the page for this episode on the website and you'll be in the running to win a Target novelisation of your choice from a selection we have available. Our next episode will be out next week, discussing the Crotons and the Seeds of Death.
Yay.
Seeds of Death, Seeds of Doom. I always get them mixed up. No, it's Seeds of Death. Don't look at me confused.
I was going to do that. I was trying to work out whether to go... But then I realised that Bernard Breslau's not in Seeds of Death.
No, that's right.
He doesn't do that.
It's
the foam machine is back.
The foam machine is back. Hooray. And also, the anniversary theme continues with one of the guest stars of the Crotons, being quite famous for having played a role in a Hartnell story, but we'll talk about that more next time. Goodbye.
Oh, goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
You've been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Surprise, I've Got a Mustache, was recorded on November the 30th. The next episode will be released on December 21st. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. This episode is dedicated to Ian Fairbairn, who played Gregory in The Invasion.
I'm going to say the word tiresome over and over again. Oh, we're recording.
Yeah.